Danielle Green will always remember Miss Finley, her first and second grade teacher.
She just kind of really pushed me out of my shell in a lot of different ways, academically, personally. I remember she had this saying, and it was huge on her blackboard, and I had her for 2 years, so it's like ingrained in the back of my mind, and it said, "I can." And that was something that I definitely carried with me for a really long time.
Danielle Green spent the last 5 years in Richmond Public Schools. She was in the second cohort of the Richmond Teacher Residency Program, and she taught social studies at Bouchon Middle School. In late August, she was a featured speaker at the Convocation for VCU School of Education.
I'm so happy to be speaking to a room that will cultivate and groom our future into the best and the brightest. Whether your path is headed towards policy, administration, counseling, research, or teaching, be conscious of the fact that you have the ability to mold, to build, or to break down human beings. Whether you intend to work with children, adult learners, or persons with disabilities, which I will point out is not mutually exclusive from the first two, you have come to a university, or you are at a university that is emboldening you and will place you in a position to make this world a better place for someone else.
Green says educators shoulder a lot. In addition to teaching, they're expected to be nurses, counselors, first-line psychologists, and therapists.
There are very few professions that are asked to be so many of those things all at once. And in that, we can become overwhelmed. And when your own frustrations seep through, then sometimes it can be a very frustrating place, and you can end up taking that out on students. And so that's something that I just wanted people to think about is, you know, we have all of these different roles, but at the end of the day, students are there. They're students. And so we can't take our frustrations out on them.
Green says recognizing and responding to implicit bias is also a critical part of building stronger classrooms.
I am a believer that everyone has bias. Everyone of some way, shape, form, we all have it. And it can be either things that we were brought up with. They can be societal, things that, messages that society has kind of infused into us, or just assumptions that we've made on our own. And the important part about that is to make sure that we don't allow our implicit biases to negatively impact the children that we work with or the people, because, some people are adult educators, and that's why I often try to steer towards like human beings instead of children. But I don't think enough teachers are aware of their own implicit biases. And that's why I said what I said, because nobody wants to be biased. Nobody wants to be prejudiced. Nobody wants to be any of those like things that have negative connotations. But the only way that we can fight through those biases and to fight through those types of things is by acknowledging that we have them in the first place, and acknowledging that we do have the power as someone's instructional leader to put them on a path for worse things. I had a math teacher that I just really did not do well with, and it really colored my opinion of math, but not just math, but like my own abilities with math. And I believe that that process happened because of she had her own implicit biases that came out that I received as a child. We have the power to make or break other people in ways that I'm not sure other professions necessarily always have. And that's because people look to us to be the good in their lives. When you look at teachers or maybe nurses or a lot of different service fields, people are looking to us to build them up. And when we tear them down, it hurts so much more than I think when someone else does it. And I think as educators, we need to always be conscious of the fact that just as much as you might be building one child up, you might be tearing another one down with the same statement or the same activity or offhand comment. And we need to be especially conscious of the way that we navigate those spaces, because so many children depend on us, so many adults depend on us. And to not acknowledge our implicit bias, to not acknowledge that we are not perfect, that we get frustrated, that we sometimes say things in an offhanded way that might come across incorrectly to someone else, is to put the people that we work with at a disadvantage.
And when you think about teachers, they spend a substantial amount of time with children or adult learners.
More time than they do with really anyone else, especially elementary school teachers, because they have those same students for, you know, 8 hours out of the day. I teach middle school, but my students still spend more time with us than they do with anyone else during the school year. And the school year is longer than the summer vacation. So really throughout the year, there is no one else that they spend more time with than they do with their educators.
And that's why we remember the teachers that either built us up or broke us down.
We always remember them. And there's some teachers, you know, you don't remember every teacher in your life. And that could be for positive or negative reasons or neutral reasons. But we especially remember the teachers that built us up. And we definitely remember the teachers that tore us down.
In her speech, Danielle Green said, educators aren't meant to look at students as numbers, as a means to an end, as receptacles that are meant for filling.
Regardless of the age level or the ability of your students, we are meant to perceive them as we would want to be perceived, as people with feelings, families, faiths, and fears. If at any point you feel as though you are incapable of working for the betterment of all people, embracing their races, ability levels, native languages, economic statuses, religions, or sexualities, education is not the place for you. I know this is contrary to what you kind of expect to hear before a new term begins, but it must be said, and it must be said early.
How did you practice this in the classroom? How did seeing your students as people with feelings and families and fears come through in your teaching?
I have the great privilege of teaching social studies. And I say privilege because I can navigate my students' humanity in a different way than teachers of different subjects, other subjects can. And that's not to say that other subjects cannot, but I deal with humans in my subject matter. And even teaching civics or government or economics, they're all connected into how humans have built, like how a bill becomes a law or things like that. And so we have a lot of discussions, debates about humanity and humanness. And I've taught, you know, U.S. history from 1865, so post-Civil War, to the present, which is a really exciting subject. And so when we are talking about different things in class, history-related things in class, their opinions come through strong. It can be just as subjective subject as it is objective. And listening to them and listening to their stories and listening to how their brain wraps around certain concepts like democracy or limited government, I get to see a lot of their personal personality. And so that makes them incredibly human for me. Because when we talk about things like the Westboro Baptist Church and hate speech versus free speech, and they start talking about how they perceive things, you know, faith comes into that. If they prescribe to a certain faith or if they don't, or if they don't have faith of any kind, that's something that we talk about in class. And there's so many different things we talk about inside of the classroom in terms of how society works that allows me to really see their own humanity. And I really feel privileged to have them in the eighth grade, because they're old enough to defend their thoughts and their feelings and explain why. But at the same time, they are still looking for guidance in a lot of different ways. And so they want to know that it's okay to have the thoughts that they that they have. And regardless of if I disagree with them or not, my job is to validate them and, you know, teach them how to think, not what to think. So I get to see a lot of that. Now, subject matter aside, I have the best of relationships with my students. And, you know, I hug them before they come into the classroom. I make sure I know all of their names before the second week of school. Like, that's my first weekend, putting faces to names, making sure that I understand why homework is done why homework is not done some of the time, because it's not just because a child doesn't want to. I mean, sometimes I don't get my lesson plans done on time, not because my lesson plans aren't of a priority to me, but because I have other things to do and or things that are kind of more concerning. And I think that every day with my students, I make sure that when they walk in the door, I try to see them as a human. And my goal often in my social studies classroom is to get them to see their classmates as humans. A lot of the work that I do, because I am in middle school, they're in this mode of thinking where they feel like everyone's looking at them and they're kind of like in their own little bubbles psychologically and focused, you know, self-centered on themselves, which makes sense. A lot of us become very aware of who we are and what we're developing into in middle school. And so what I try to do is not just make sure that I see them as humans and I see like what's going on in their lives, but make sure that they're doing the same for each other.
Green says it's important to be there for students after traumatic events like police shootings and the recent neo-Nazi rallies. She says while complex and difficult, these issues can't be ignored.
I remember some of the most miserable experiences that I had, and I'm thinking of college when catastrophic events happened and teachers came in and were, you know, the day moved on. And there was no acknowledgement that some of the people in the classroom collectively were struggling, were not concentrating, were uncomfortable. Because instead of having that conversation that would have kind of eased tensions in the classroom, they did what was comfortable for them and they ignored it. As an instructor, I don't think that we can do that. Maybe I see the understanding for it maybe in a college space. I'm not an advocate of that in any space, honestly. But in K through 12 education, I think that's something that it needs to be discussed. And so on days after the election, Baltimore, Ferguson, I wiped my day clean and I just pushed back my schedule. So for Charlottesville, when to show you what it would look like in my classroom, possibly, they'd come in the room, the date would be on the board, and the word Charlottesville would be on the board, or another word, maybe white supremacy or neo-Nazism, Nazism, period. And usually what I do is I have them come in and take out a sheet of paper. There's one word on the board, and I want them to free write. And that's how we start.
The strategy Green uses is think, pair, share. After free writing for a few minutes, students have the option to pair up and share their thoughts or exchange their papers. Then she moves class into group discussion based on questions, facts they can look up, articles they can read, or videos they can watch.
And it just gives them a space to process. Are there tears? Yes. Are there arguments? Yes. I mean, it's not like a happy-go-lucky space. These aren't happy-go-lucky issues. And that's okay because they need that space. And maybe they didn't learn what they needed to learn for my SOL that day. But maybe they'll go to the next class more able to focus because they've been able to get it out. And or come back the next day if I have them at the end of the class period. And I think that it builds their trust for me. They see that I know that they're affected by things outside of the classroom. And ultimately, I think it makes them work harder for me on other days because they know that I see them and I see that there are things that are going on in life that affect them. It makes them better, I guess, students.
You've been with RPS for a number of years. Where do you see the most progress? And what are your suggestions for some of the biggest challenges the district is facing right now?
One of my favorite things that Richmond has done is create, I think it was under Dr. Bedden, the FACE department. And it's called, I think it's Family and Community Engagement. And it's been a department that's really attempted to focus on how do we bring families into, you know, our education space? How do we make sure that students' needs are met, not just inside the classroom, but also outside of the classroom, whether it be language barriers or socioeconomic status or transportation to certain things? I feel like that is an amazing step in the right direction to recognizing the whole child. You know, they don't leave their problems at the door. And so trying to develop a space where we focus on not only the students, but on their families and on communities is phenomenal. For Richmond Public Schools, where I think that they need to go to get to where they need to be, the one thing that I want to say is they need to listen to their teachers a bit more than I feel like they have been doing in the past. There have been surveys, and I did like that. They've been sending out surveys about, you know, your opinions on this or climate surveys. A lot of us, however, still don't feel heard. And because we're on the front lines of educating these students, it is very difficult to have some type of systemic change that does not involve teachers. And yes, there are school boards and we can go to those, but so many teachers have families and can't make it out to those things. And that's not to create an excuse, but to, from top down, start investing more in the voices of their teachers, because we're the ones who work with the students. We're the ones that see the needs that they have. We are the ones who are developing the lessons. We are the ones that have to make sure that the curriculum is taught. We're the ones that are responsible for those scores at the end of the day. So I think that not only by bringing in those family, you know, the family and community voices, there needs to be a concerted effort to bring the voices of teachers to the forefront. And until they do so, I don't see it developing into the district that we all know that it can be.
Danielle Green comes from a long line of educators. Her grandmother was an elementary school teacher in Richmond for 3 decades, and her mother, Daisy Green, just retired after 31 years in Richmond Public Schools.
My mom has always told me that at the end of the day, you're there for the children. And there's so many politics wrapped up into schools and into education. And whatever needs to be done for your kids is what you need to do. And I find that to be incredibly solid advice, because there are days where you can just get so wrapped up into the numbers, into what, you know, you need to turn in, into all these things, that you can neglect what your kids need or why you're there in the first place. I think likewise, my mom has always taught me that I needed to be what I've heard other people say, and she's never used this word, but I've heard other people use it, is being a warm demander. And I really have lived my educational career by that. You can demand things of your students, and you should demand things of your students, have high expectations, but you need to be warm with them. You need to make sure that, and I use the word human a lot, but they see you as a human. Apologize to your students when you're wrong. That's a huge piece of advice. I don't remember too many times where I was apologized to as a student, or that I've heard other educators apologize to their students. I have, but it's not as abundant as it needs to be, because they need to know that you make mistakes too. They need to know that if you make a mistake, it's okay. This is a safe space to acknowledge that, because then they mimic you. My students mimic me in so many different ways as they get more comfortable with me, and making sure that I'm warm in the way that I interact with them, but at the same time, I demand that they do what is expected of them has been some of like the best advice that my mom has given me. You know, just be there for the kids. At the end of the day, that's what you're there for. And make sure you warmly demand the highest of things from them.
Danielle Green is now at Stanford University, pursuing a PhD in curriculum and teacher education. She wants to start her research by looking at cross-cultural teacher-student relationships in urban education.
In public schools in America, the vast majority of teachers are white women. And that is no longer what our student populace looks like. The vast majority of our students are now of color. And there, in urban areas, there's a high concentration of poverty. Statistically, most of the teachers that are teaching are middle class. So you have a class difference, and then there's, you know, race cultural differences. And so I want to look at how we can bridge cultural divides between teacher and student in social studies classes to ensure that students are able to learn. It's not just like a white-black dichotomy either. You know, the school that I taught in has a burgeoning Latino community. I am not Latino. I'm black. And so when first navigating those spaces, there wasn't anything that I felt like had prepared me for that prior to. And so it was a difficult space to navigate. I feel like I mastered it. I have great relationships with all of my students, but it took time. And it was something that I felt like I should have learned or even discussed before I had stepped foot into the classroom. And so I want to take all of that, you know, social studies classrooms, cross-cultural student-teacher relationships, and then hone in on how we can put that into teacher education. I feel like a lot of our teachers are not being adequately prepared for those types of situations or settings in their classrooms. I don't feel like I was prepared for that, and that's, you know, to no fault of any one person. I think it's a systemic issue. And I think that I've watched a lot of teachers struggle with making those connections and not necessarily knowing where to go from what point. And a lot of great teachers seek out extra help or, you know, professional development or research things on their own. But it needs to be something that is discussed and taught before you ever step foot into a classroom. You have to have realistic expectations of what's going to happen in your room and how you're going to be able to work with students, because I'm a firm believer that students work best for teachers that they like. And, you know, you often hear people say, well, they don't have to like me. I disagree. I don't think you should be like, that should be your main goal in the classroom, is to have your students like you. But students are happiest and work hardest and learn the most from teachers that they like, that they respect, that they feel respect them, and that they're most comfortable around. And there are a lot of bridges to cross when you have a teacher teaching a student that's unlike them. And you might go into a setting where the majority of the students are like you. But what about the two or three that are nothing like you? How do we bring them in? How do we use social studies to kind of bridge that gap?
For new and veteran teachers, Green also has some simple advice. One of the best qualities a teacher can have is patience. She says it comes in different forms, shapes, and lengths, but can allow teachers to go much further with their students than they imagined. For Learning Curve, I'm Catherine Comp, WCVE News.